The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, A Life in Politics with Paddy Ashdown, was recorded at King's Place, London in November 2015. Paddy Ashdown is in conversation with Observer Associate Editor and Chief Political Commentator Andrew Rawnsley.
All right, there, left.
Good evening, everybody. My welcome to you to this Guardian Live event, and my special welcome to our guest this evening, Paddy Ashdown. And since he really needs no introduction, I'm not going to bother introducing him. Before we get up to date with contemporary political events, this sort of thing, I like to delve into somebody's life, their backstory, and Paddy's got plenty of backstory to talk about, because it's often, actually, with politicians, more illuminating to talk about, say, their childhood than their current political views, which can be shifting, but their childhoods can't really change. Paddy, you were christened Jeremy John Durham Ashdown, but everybody knows you as Paddy. How did that come about? Remind us.
I'm the child of a Northern Ireland Irish Protestant mother and a Southern Irish Catholic father. I was brought up in Northern Ireland and had a broad Northern Ireland accent, so that when I went to school, first off, at the age of 4 or 5 to primary school, they asked me, well, are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic? So I went home, and we never discussed this in my family. I asked my dad, Dad, am I a Protestant or a Catholic? He said, go back and tell him you're a Muslim. So I went back and said, I'm a Muslim. And they said, yeah, but are you a Protestant Muslim or are you a Catholic Muslim? So at the age of 11, when I was sent across the water to my father's school, where he was head of the house and where eventually I was too, isn't that posh and terribly public school? I, of course, had a broad Northern Irish accent. Now, the one thing you don't call a Northern Irishman, if you know anything about Ireland, is Paddy. But, of course, nobody in England knows anything about Ireland at all. So if I had a broad Northern Irish accent, I had to be a Paddy. And Paddy has ever been... And I then, when I left school and I went on to join the Royal Marines, about 13 of my schoolmates went with me, and the name just went from one to the other. And I'm not at all unhappy. I have to say, in all other senses, Andrew, I have lost, as you hear from my voice, my Northern Irish roots and the blood, although I'm very proud of it, and that's the only thing that remains. And to be honest, I feel a little bit more like a Paddy one way or another than a Jeremy. I don't really feel at all like a Jeremy. Mr. Corbyn, please forgive me, but I don't.
Now, you mentioned your ancestry in Northern Ireland, and although the accent's gone, do you still feel yourself to be Irish? Do you
yes.
have an Irish temperament in
any Oh, yes, anyway? Absolutely an Irish temperament.
How does that express itself?
Oh, I can lose my temper very quickly, and it's a bad thing to do, but I've never quite been able to control it. I also have a capacity. Actually, I think I've done it to you once, and I had to apologise and buy you a bottle of champagne afterwards. When I'm really angry, I insult people outrageously, and then I forget it about 10 seconds later.
And they don't know.
No, they don't. They come up to me years later and they're still deeply offended, and I'm genuinely perplexed about what it was about. Not in your case, because we fix that. We fix that quite soon afterwards, because you were a bit tough with me. But so that's certainly Irish. I'm passionate about things, very passionate about them. I can't see any point. So one of my great mottos of my life was, I can never remember, was it Socrates or was it Plato who said, the unexamined life is not worth living? And so I am constantly pushing, constantly examining, constantly re-examining, constantly getting committed and usually with great passion. And that's sort of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about your father, John. He was a soldier. Mm. And at the evacuation from Dunkirk, he was ordered to abandon his men, disobeyed the order, was court-martialed, and then later exonerated.
You know, it is an Irish trait. It is an Irish trait a bit to never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Okay, what's the truth?
What is true?
Well, that's what Wikipedia says. Yeah, I should have known better.
Absolutely. What is true is that he was an Indian Army officer, bought his Indian troops, God knows what they thought, landed at Marseille, marched north to just south of Lille with their mules. He was in charge of a troop of mules, and they were resupplying ammunition on the front line. And then when the Germans came at a rush, they all evacuated Dunkirk. He got them all to Dunkirk without losing a single person. That's not bad. I think that's an extraordinary achievement, given that none of them would understand France or the French. They abandoned their mules. I did hear a story, actually not from my father, but from my family, that he was ordered to abandon his men by a staff officer who came and said, hey, officers have got to get back to England, men don't matter, you better abandon them. And he refused, and the story goes on that he was indeed court-martialed, but then the court-martial, the officer who gave the order, was the person who was condemned. But I have to say, when I wrote my life history, I went back to see if I could find any evidence for the story, and I couldn't find any solid evidence for it anyway. Such a pity.
It's still a very good story.
Yeah, cracking story.
Now, your mother, she was a nurse. What sort of personality was she?
My dad was the adventurer. And by the way, you often replicate your family in the family you were brought up in and the family that you create. And he was an adventurer. He was a pusher. He loved argument. He loved furious argument. Always furious argument in my family. I'm the eldest of seven. There are only three of us left now. He was turbulent, challenging, difficult. I loved him to pieces. And although he died before I was elected, one of my greatest sorrows, it's still the case that if I am faced with something, a decision to take, forgive me, I have a little thing with the throat. If I'm faced with something, a decision to take, I often ask myself, what would he have done? You know, I'd love to have he saw me elected. He saw me in my first election campaign, which I lost. My mum was, as my wife is, the calm center of the family, with this raging turbulence going on around her, people shouting at each other and storming out. She sort of sat at the center of this and dished out dollops of clotted cream, dollops of unconditional love to everybody around. She held us all together, really.
You know, you joined the Royal Marines in 1959, serving until 1972. Why the Marines? What was the attraction of the Royal Marines?
My family ran out of money when my father was an Indian Army officer, retired, came back to Northern Ireland, started a pig farm. He was a wonderful man, but not a good businessman. We ran out of money. I was near... If the money was going to last for my brother to go to the same school as I went to, I had to get a scholarship. And I got a naval scholarship at the age of 16. I'd fallen in love with the Navy rather romantically at the age of 4, but I'd stuck with the idea right the way through. I soon realized that I probably wasn't going to be a good naval officer, and so I joined the Royal Marines. And in a way, if I had not done so, then my brother couldn't have gone to school. Now, that sounds as though I made a sacrifice. I don't think I did. I was a romantic. I did believe in the best aspects of soldiering. The Royal Marines attracted me as an active, and it was seemed to me, if you want to be a soldier, that's a good form of soldiering to do. And in retrospect, I have to say, at the age of 18 or 19, turbulent, tear away, the whole of my university years, if I'd have gone to university, I could have done. Would have been wasted in booze and girls and rugby, I suspect. Well, that sounds fun, doesn't it? Wouldn't it do that?
Wasted, I mean, that's wasted. Arguable, isn't it?
The Royal Marines were exactly right for me. They taught me all sorts of things that I still benefit from. So they were exactly right. I mean, The book I wrote, by the way, Andrew wasn't going to say it first, but it is available for sale outside.
I made him getting a plug contingent on his behaviour,
and we're so not far, rather
far
good.
Enough into so the far, interview so yet far, to decide whether you so deserve
far,
the plug.
So far, rather good. So I'm doing the plug myself. I called it A Fortunate Life. Almost none of my life's been the result of considered thought. Almost all of my life has happened to me. But almost all of it, strangely, has been extremely, you know, I've been very fortunate. The Royal Marines, between the ages of 18 and 31 when I left, was exactly right and gave me experiences and gave me, above all, something lacking in modern politicians who have never been anything else but politicians, a capacity to know, understand and calculate risk. And therefore, be prepared to take risks, which has stood me in good order.
And of course, you had to particularly be able to do that when you joined the elite section of the Royal Marines, the Special Boat Squadron. Now, you once told me a brilliant story about one of your exploits when you were with the SBS, when you had to go and retrieve a dictator's turd. Do you remember that?
Share why
you had to retrieve a dictator's turd with the
Andrew,
audience.
You are a very good journalist. I love reading your columns, but your memory is defective. I'm glad to say...
That's why I wouldn't let him have the plug.
Now, this is a story about MI6. I was fighting a little war in Borneo, one of the last of the imperial wars in the jungles of Borneo, about the same time as Vietnam, except we won, and they didn't. And MI6 at that stage was running a station in Jakarta, because we still had relations with Jakarta. And I told you the story about what went on while I was in Borneo, but they were doing this operation. And at that stage, and indeed I'm sure it's true now, if I tell you the story, I have to eat you. You realize that? An intelligence station will have a series of requirements. In other words, the things that London wants you to get hold of. And at that stage, some madman in London had decided that looking at the television pictures of General Sukarno, who was the dictator of Indonesia, who we were fighting, they thought the signs of a deadly and mortal illness. In order to discover this illness, they had to get hold of one of his turds. So this became... Are we allowed to say this?
The number one
intelligence requirements for the MI6 station in Jakarta was to obtain one of his turds. And they didn't manage to do it, I'm told. I mean, this may be apocryphal, but I heard it when I joined an organisation not wholly unconnected. Anyway, they said, look, they recruited the chambermaid and they did all sorts of things. And they couldn't obtain this article until eventually the Russians discovered the tunnel we'd been digging under the wall in Berlin to tap into the Russian cables. And they discovered it. And suddenly we had a lot of sort of out-of-work MI6 tunnels. So somebody thought, tell you what we'll do. We'll buy a house just outside the Palais. This is true, by the way. The Presidential Palace grounds, which became an MI6 safe house. And they... God, I do have to eat you all. And then they flew the tunnellers in from Berlin. They must have been quite glad to be in Jakarta. And dug this tunnel from there to... They got someone to provide a blueprint of the Sukarno Presidential Palace, so we knew where the presidential loo was.
Yes.
And they made sure the
gold-plated
tunnel
intercepted
the presidential drain. And they put a little trap in there, and boop, out of it one day popped the article that was necessary. So this is a great story, don't you agree? And they smuggled it back into the safe house. And then it was passed through dead letterbox to dead letterbox, smuggled by agents. Ooh, you may imagine what state it is. And eventually, according to the story, sent back to London in the diplomatic bag, where it was duly analysed, and he was discovered not to have the disease. So there you are. Even if that story isn't true, it ought to be, don't you think so?
Yeah, it certainly should be. Now, my old friend Mike White, he used to joke when he wrote the parliamentary sketch for The Guardian that you were the only politician who could kill another politician with his bare hands. Is that true?
No, Mike White's story is not true, because it wasn't he who said
Thank
it. It was Clement Freud who said it first off. And then Mike wrote it, I remember, and Charles Kennedy claimed it as one of his. It was Clay Freud's joke, but a good joke.
Is it true?
I'm not going to tell you, or I'd have to kill you.
Now, No, I'm not going to bother with this because you'll tell me I've got it wrong. Yes, I am, because it's a good story. I seem to remember when you met your wife, or future wife, as she was then, Jane, her first sight of you was stark staring naked. Is that right?
No.
Where's that one come from?
I haven't a clue. It is true that when I met Jane first off, my parents had just left for Australia, and all my brothers and sisters and had left me behind, and I was 18, and I'd just joined my Royal Marines, and it was the first Christmas ball. I was 18, and my cousin came with me, and my best friend's cousin came with him. And they were staying at a little pub just outside the Royal Marines base, the Commando Training Centre in Lympston, and I got the wrong cousin and walked in to her bedroom. She was nearly stark staring naked, but I was fully dressed.
But the point of the joke was it love at first sight?
It was love at one and a half sight. I mean, I think actually we did that business of falling in love the following day, because the Royal Marines is a sort of pretty rough and ready, brutal organisation, and perhaps not many of my fellow officers had an attachment to literature and poetry. Some did, and I loved them, especially one man called Jeremy Moore was my first company commander, and then commanded the commandos in the Falklands, a remarkable man, not long dead. And my wife and I actually met at a lunch with my fellow officers, which both of us found rather boring, so we went off around Exeter Cathedral, and that was where we fell in love, really.
What was the... I mean, when
it's quite romantic, isn't it?
Yeah. When you were with the SBS, what was the scariest mission you went on, do you think?
They're all scary. My rule of thumb was always that I would never take anybody on operations who wasn't at least as frightened as me. And it's not a bad judgment, because anybody who's not frightened in those circumstances really doesn't understand, and they're the really dangerous ones. So, you know, I think you never treat any of those experiences lightly. And I don't imagine for a moment that I was doing things which... My guess is that the young soldiers, and particularly my wonderful comrades still in the SBS, in the context of Afghanistan, did things which required a higher degree, 10 times higher degree of professionalism and courage than anything I was asked to do. But it was all right.
Now, after the Royal Marines, you went to Geneva, and for a while you used to euphemistically...
By the way, am I allowed to say a very rude word here?
Rude. You don't mind, do you? Do you mind rude?
One of my favourite SBS stories is actually about the great Newby, the writer of the... why is the first name gone? The writer of Love and War and the Apennines and the Hindu Kush, Eric Newby. He lived just a little way down from us in Methley Street, and he tells a lovely story. He was in the original SBS, and they were landing one night at the on a beach to blow up some German aircraft, and the Germans knew. And Newby invented standard operating procedure number one in the SBS. So they landed, they were about to put these bombs on the German aircraft. The Germans spotted them, all fire, searchlights. And the young officer called them together and said, "Right, chaps, I think what we should do now is..." And a big gruff sergeant in the back said, "What we should do now, sir, is fuck off very quickly." and this became standard operating procedure number one in the SBS, which I have to say we used on a great number of times.
Now, after the Marines, you left and you joined what for a while you used to euphemistically called the Shadows. In fact, you joined MI6, didn't you, the Secret Intelligence
Service? I'm not allowed to tell you what I did in this organisation, Andrew, and I'm not going to.
It was a long time ago.
No, I can tell you.
The 30-year rule doesn't apply.
No, that's not the point.
Would you have to kill us all if you told us?
Absolutely. Eat you, but probably after killing you. You can make your own judgment. This was working for an organisation which was certainly in the business of intelligence, on serving Her Majesty's government. But I took an agreement at that stage not to acknowledge the organisation I worked for. I am allowed to say some of the things that we did, but I stick to that agreement if I made it.
But it's all out in the open now, isn't it? I mean, we've gone of the days when we didn't even know who the head of MI6 was.
Yeah, well, you're right to know, and quite right, it's now, it was undeclarable, but it's declarable. Yes, you're allowed to know that, but you're not allowed to know. Anyway, look, if it's all out in the open, why are you asking me?
Since we're touching on this area, where are you now, considering the legislation Theresa May's bringing forward, in the balance between the needs of security and the worries of many people that liberty and privacy...
You mean the communications interception?
Yes, yeah. are you comfortable with that or not?
No, I'm not. Let me tell you a little story, if I can. When I joined this organisation, which I'm not allowed to tell you about, they took me into a very large shed as part of our training. And you opened the doors. It was a huge shed. It was down near the post office tower at one stage. Huge, and you opened the door, and you were assailed by this wave of steam. And what you then discover is that what you're looking at is a large shed, bigger than this hall, full of post office engineers, each with a steaming kettle on their desk, steaming open the citizens' letters. And this was interception of communications circa 1971, 72. Since then, obviously, it's changed. but the principles that applied then ought to apply now. In order for one of these well-meaning and extremely diligent post office engineers to steam open your letter, you had to be a target. In other words, you had to be a specific person to whom the security services applied to look at their communications. So it had to be individual. Couldn't be a class of people, couldn't be all blacks, all Jews, let alone all the country. It had to be a single individual. And then the request had to be supported by evidence as to which what they wanted to do this for. And then that had to be agreed in that case by the Home Secretary or by a judge, somebody charged with the protection of the law. Now, although it's obviously changed, I think those principles shouldn't. I think we should adhere to those principles. It's only safe to have this power if you do. So I thoroughly object to the idea that everybody in the country will be treated as a country of suspects. All individual communications, the fact of them, not the content, is enabled to be known by the state, and the state control them as they wish. The laws originally introduced by Labour were disgraceful. I mean, how Labour ever got away with it, I don't know, because actually even Theresa May is now framing laws which are less open, not to corruption, but to abuse. The number of applications, not only from the political departments, intelligence services, from local governments and many others, were numbering about, I can't remember, I think I'm right, the figures were 3 million. 3 million a year to be able to look at this communications. So no, I don't agree with them at all. And I think that any application to look at either the fact that I communicated with Andrew Rawnsley a year ago without the substance, and indeed what the substance is, ought to be governed by those same principles. You might have a lower level of evidence necessary to know the fact and a higher to know the content, but that's still what should apply. And above all, in the case of the interception of the communications of a citizen of this country, that should be agreed, validated, and authorized, preferably by a judge, or in some circumstances by a minister of the state accountable to parliament.
I guess one of the things people who work for your former employer would come back with, they'd say, you know, that might be all very well in the days where there were just hardline telephones and steaming open people's mail if there was reason to suspect them. But I'll just present the argument to you. But nowadays we're faced with a situation where, God forbid, some awful terrorist atrocity may happen, and we need to be able to look back through people's communications and browsers to establish who was in the conspiracy. And if the digital companies have already wiped all this, it's going to be much harder to catch these people.
Yeah, but you have to make judgments. It is the job of of course the intelligence services want more power. I don't blame them for that. We charge them with keeping us safe. Of course they want the maximum amount of power. Of course they want to not have any mistakes on their watch. But the job of a politician in a democracy is to be jealous about giving away those freedoms and to do them only when it's necessary. And yes, you have to make a judgment as to how many cases this would arise in the form that you take and how much infringement of the liberty of the citizen that there is.
Now, I have to say to you that I have, of course, taken some soundings amongst old friends. And I have to say to you, without wishing to be specific in any way whatsoever, they do not take the attitude you take. Many, many in the intelligence services believe that what Theresa May is doing will so flood them with information that, in fact, they will never find
there's
the pin amongst the fudge. Exactly. Yeah. And what's more, they think many of them, some of them have gone public about it. One particular ex-SIS man has gone public about it, saying that he believes this goes far, far too far. In the end, you have to remember what we are fighting these battles for. And we are fighting them for the preservation of our liberties and our freedoms. That's what differentiates. If we give those away wholesale, as I'm afraid we will in these circumstances, then, you know, we are allowing the terrorists to win the battle without a single shot, and I'm not in favour of that.
Let's dig back into the flow of the Paddy Ashdown life story. So there you are in Geneva, working for this organisation we're not allowed to name. It seems to be quite a nice life there. You had a house on the shores of Lake Geneva. Lots of opportunities for skiing, sailing, climbing. Lovely, 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 lovely. And then you did something your friends all thought was utterly bonkers. You decided you want to be not only a politician, but a liberal.
And
why?
And a liberal, not only a liberal, but a liberal in a seat where the Tories had been in power since 1910.
Yes. And when the leader of the Liberal Party was about to face the Old Bailey for conspiracy to commit murder.
When I was selected for the Liberals, they were third in a seat that had been Tory since 1910. I think on the night or within a week of my leader being arraigned at the Old Bailey for conspiracy to murder. These were not easy times, I have to tell you. But look, you have to go back a bit. I am a profound... One of the things I went into... I detest, hate and abominate the class system in our country. It's an impediment to success and a repression of individuals. I also believe that this country would be immensely better if it was a meritocracy. When I was in... Strangely enough, my liberal beliefs formulated, crystallized, when I was in the special boat section, when it was my job to command men in quite difficult circumstances who were, by any standard, better at the job we were supposed to be doing than I was. And I was in my position because of an act of the class system and because of my parents. And so I just thought if only we could... I was originally Labour, by the way. Well, everybody's entitled to their youthful folly. I was in Labour in the days of Roy Jenkins and Shirley Williams and those stars. And that's what made me a liberal, I think, more than anything else. So here I was in Geneva. Yes, you're absolutely right, living a very comfortable life, two children. We had a house right on the shore of Lake Geneva. We did ski in the winter. We did walk in the mountains. They are the ones that my wife and I look back on the halcyon days. Our kids were 8 and 10. But 1974, when I went there, was two elections, three-day week. Who rules Britain? Is it the trade unions? Is it the democratic government? I had to represent my country in the daytime job in various UN institutions, and we were the sick man of Europe. And gradually I came to the view, what the hell is your life about? I know this sounds sort of self-congratulatory and a bit pious now, but genuinely, my wife and I thought, well, you know, what is the point of this? We're living very well, earning a good salary. And so... So, I decided we'd give it all up and go and fight with the Liberals in Yeovil, not having the first idea what that actually meant. I mean, I presumed that I, being such a remarkable and wonderful person, obviously, I would descend on Yeovil. I might have to do a
They'd fall in love instantly.
Instantly. And I might have to do a strawberry cream tea or two or something like that, but inevitably they were going to elect me, weren't they? No, they weren't. It took me 8 years, two periods of unemployment. My family were... We were down to the last £100 at one stage.
Was there any point Jane said to you, Paddy, we're down to our last £100,
do
something sensible?
No, there wasn't. But there was a time, I've been trying to get a job for a year. I'm the only Member of Parliament to go into the House on the unemployed register. I was working for the community programme as a youth worker in Dorset. By the way, a wonderful job, and I learned a huge amount there too. But there was a day I said to her, look, Jenny, if I can't get a job within a week or so, we're going to have to give this up. And then something remarkable happened. Someone, very nice organisation called the Roundtree Trust, sent me a cheque for £1,000 in order to be able to stick it out. I got a job, and I was elected on the second go in 1983. So, I mean,
just go back to that decision. It was a hopelessly irresponsible decision to take. Hopelessly. With a wife and two children. It was undoubtedly resulted in the most difficult 8 years of our lives. I owe a fantastic amount to my kids and to Jane for holding the thing together and sticking with me throughout the process. Very difficult, very tough, and yet undoubtedly the best decision of my life. I mean, my life simply would not have been the same if I hadn't taken that. So there you are.
So you come into the House Commons in 1983 after this 8-year battle. And you quite quickly become a rising star of your party. I can remember, I think it was at Eastbourne Conference, where David Steele, the then leader, was struggling to convince the Liberal Party to adopt his position on nuclear weapons. And this rising star, Paddy Ashdown, took to the podium and made a very passionate speech denouncing cruise missiles. And poor old David was defeated by his own conference. Where are you on nuclear weapons and the deterrent these days? Are you with Jeremy Corbyn and others who say...
No, I'm not. No. And I wasn't then. And no. People often say I was a member of CND. I wasn't. I never believed in unilateral disarmament. But I didn't believe in unilateral rearmament. And the point about Cruz was it was unilateral rearmament by the Americans. They weren't, you know... I do believe in, I'm afraid, in the deterrent. No, I'm afraid. It's a very difficult thing to argue, but I do. I do think it has an effect. I've never been in favour of unilateral disarmament, but I am not in favour of unilateral rearmament. The Americans were deliberately stoking up the Cold War at a very dangerous point, stationing cruise missiles in Britain, which I believed was not necessary, and indeed in due course turned out not to be necessary. So, no, I hold the same position as I hold then. I'd like to see a minimalist deterrent. I don't think Trident in its present form and present numbers is the kind of...
You wouldn't renew Trident, then? You wouldn't embrace
I wouldn't renew it at its present level. Absolutely not.
What would you have instead, then?
Well, a deterrent is a deterrent if you're waving it around in somebody's face, and it's also a deterrent if it's in the sheath. So I think the idea of reducing the number of Tridents from 4 to 3... Is it 5? I can't remember. Is absolutely right. You can have your Trident, therefore, not always permanently at sea. You can put to sea quickly in time of threat. You massively reduce the number of nuclear weapons. You're contributing to non-proliferation and the reduction of weapons in the world. You're doing the best you can do with what is the cheapest option. I'm afraid Trident is the cheapest option. Because we've looked at all others, but you are having a deterrent consistent with the level of the threat at the time. So I think the right thing to do is to renew Trident at a lower level operation. Don't worry about continuous round-the-clock deployment. That deterrent remains a deterrent if it's in the sheath. That seems to be sensible.
Now, one of the arguments from the other side is deterrence theory might be all very well in the days of the Cold War. It was understandable then. But exactly who are we deterring now? Anyway, isn't the threat much more a terrorist threat?
Yeah, but it doesn't mean to say...
It's not one big power loosing off all its nuclear weapons at another.
No, it's absolutely not. But you, in deciding on your defence dispositions, you must meet all the available threats. Absolutely. Strategic, non-parallel... What's the phrase I'm looking for? Sorry. Terrorism is a serious threat, but so is the proliferation of nuclear weapons a serious threat. It's happening on a grand scale across Britain. Don't imagine that it's only terrorism that can affect Britain. You quite easily get a rogue state. If you have...
But if they're rogue, would they actually be deterred by the fact we've got Trident?
Some of them would, not all of them. And that's good enough. You can't plan a defence for every circumstances. You've got to plan a defence on a rational basis. What is the step most likely to give you the best security? And with nuclear proliferations and the advent of rogue states, and you look around the world and you see how many nations not only have nuclear weapons, but how many are holding themselves just below the nuclear threshold, you see a very turbulent world. I think this next 2 or 3 decades are going to be as bloody and as turbulent as any we have seen in my lifetime, including the Cold War. Do I want to recommend to my country that this is the right moment for us to remove an aspect, one aspect, that deals with one particular facet of this? I couldn't sensibly say it is.
Then the problem is there never will be a right moment, will there? Because until peace and love and kumbaya breaks out globally, which isn't going to happen any time shortly, you'll always be able to say there's some sort of threat that justifies these weapons' existence.
Well, you might be able to, but nevertheless, I mean, you know, who was it? I think it was Gandhi who once said that ideas are never realized. It's our pursuit of them that changes the course of history. And so we have Obama and everybody else committed to a non-nuclear world. Will we get there quickly? I wouldn't have thought so. Will we get there at all? Well, you may be right to doubt it. But that doesn't mean to say that at any given time you need to have a disposition of your defensive capacity which meets the threat of the day. And what we do is we say, by policy I've followed, the Trident was created for the Cold War. We're no longer in the Cold War. We remove it from that status to a lower status, more closely commensurate with the threat that we face in a turbulent world where nuclear weapons are proliferating. And we do the other things as well. That seems to me a sensible, rational stance in the day, in the face of the threats that we have.
Let's return. Do you want a bit of water?
I'm all right. I'm drinking quite a lot.
Let's return to the life story. So, as we were talking about a little earlier, you're a rising star and you rise to the leadership of what has by now become, after the merger between the Liberals and the SDP, the Liberal Democrats. But you inherit the leadership in 1989, a particularly bleak period for the party. You get hammered by the Greens in the Euro elections. I think there's no money in the bank. The inheritance was pretty dismal, as I recall.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
When I was elected, 3 hours before my great announcement of my election on the steps of Cowley Street, the tax inspectors had turned up to close the Liberal Democrats down because we'd not paid our insurance. They were quickly hustled out of the way and persuaded to leave. We were massively in debt, and we were, I have to say, a laughing stock around the country, so it wasn't easy. I was very, very frightened, I have to tell you. I lay awake at night wondering whether the party that started with Gladstone would end with Ashdown, and it very nearly did. I made some bad mistakes early on. Being a leader in a political party, nothing ever prepares you for that. I don't care if you were Roy Jenkins, president of the European Commission, or Paddy Ashdown leading SBS troops up a distant beach where we shouldn't be. Nothing prepares you for that. You have to learn in this secret garden very quickly. Unfortunately, with the help of friends, we did. But it remains the case that I am the only political leader in Britain who's presided over an opinion poll rating represented by an asterisk, denoting that no detectable support could be found for us anywhere in the land. And it was a long struggle back, but we made it.
Does that give you some... we'll go on more detail a bit later, but get some comfort given your party's current plight to make you think, well, we've known worse.
This is different, Andrew, but yes, of course, if you've been through that nadir of fortune, then you are used to going through that nadir of fortune. One of the things I adore about the Lib Dems is their utter, total, bloody-minded determination to continue. And there they are out campaigning. I've been around the country. They're doing it still. And doing it greatly, and I just adore that, the ability to come back. I happen to believe that liberalism is the only creed that makes any sense of the conundrums of our time. I happen to believe that this is, everybody's trying to be a liberal. Mr. Blair told me he was one, some liberal. Mr. Cameron calls himself a liberal conservative, whatever the hell that is. So liberalism is the creed of our day. So
it's just not very good at getting elected, apart from in Canada.
That does leave me with, if it's the creed of our day, why the bloody hell aren't I Prime Minister? And of course I know the answer to that. Not enough of you bastards voted for it. Okay? So I'm quite clear about that. But I think it will come back. I think the last election, I think in the North there were many who didn't vote Liberal Democrat because they believed we'd betrayed them by going in with the Tories. But I think in the South, it was quite different. I think people would like to have voted for, actually did recognise the good work done by Lib Dem MPs, really did recognise the good work done in the coalition for all the fact that we made occasional mistakes as well. And when they didn't vote for us, they didn't vote for us because they didn't think they could afford to use their vote for anything else that's stopping Mr. Miliband and Mr. Salmond getting into number 10. And they were misled in this by the opinion polls, which showed the two parties even, Stephen, which in my view they never were. The Tories were always ahead of Labour in this. I think they were misled by the polls. So my calculation, I hope this isn't just ludicrous hope. I go around quite a lot, and I think the goodwill is still there for us. And I think we can rebuild much more quickly than people imagine we can. I think the country sort of feels it's got a government it didn't expect and probably didn't want to elect, a Tory majority. If you take all those seats south of the M4, ask you the question, you're a very close observer of politics, leaving aside the singular case of the remarkable Ben Bradshaw in Exeter, what is the most Western non-conservative seat in Britain?
The most Western
non-conservative
seat? Yeah, I think you know the answer already.
Yeah,
leaving aside Ben in Exeter. I don't know, it's some way back towards London,
It's Carshalton.
Carshalton, yeah.
Everything else is Tory. Now, if you... I believe in that most of those seats, most of them, I think, we are second. I am absolutely clear that the way this government is going, hubris is now dug deep into the Tory soul. I'm absolutely clear that we can recover our position.
We're getting slightly ahead of ourselves.
Just
a few other... it was my fault. A few other things to look at. Because before the 1997 election, when you were leading the Lib Dems at the time, there'd been talk of coalition. Then you took the Lib Dems to their best result since the 1920s, 46 seats.
Yeah.
Tony Blair's New Labour had a landslide. And you did do some cooperation with his government and got some things out of it.
A lot.
Do you ever wistful that the coalition, I think you used to call it Full Monty in your diaries.
It would have become a coalition.
Never materialised with Labour, the earlier possible opportunity moment.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it would have been... I hope it's not again ludicrously self-flattering to say that I think if that government, if the Blair government, had been a partnership government, it would have been one from the high moral ground that it wasn't necessary, but it was possible, and we'd have done that. Not because it was required by electoral mathematics, but because here were two parties who agreed about things that were important. I also think that the fact of that partnership would have prevented the Blair government deteriorating in the way that it did and at the scale it did and at the speed it did. I mean, I can think of decisions which I think... The first really bad Blair decision was, in my view, the dome. That was the moment when it occurred to me that Mr. Blair, who in many other ways was a remarkably good prime minister right up until Iraq, was too obsessed with these big-scale, high-profile things. So I think that government would have been better if it had been a partnership government. And yes, I think we lost an opportunity. By the way, I think Mr. Blair may think we lost almost the most baleful institution in the British Constitution is the Downing Street removal van. It turns up before 12 o'clock.
Yeah, it's very
on
brutal.
The day after the election. And one's gone and the other's come in. Now, you then make decisions in those first, as Prime Minister, those first 24 hours, 48 hours, with you're totally knackered. Your bloodstream is awash with a deadly mix of, I don't know, testosterone and you are not in a rational frame of mind coming out of a 7-week election.
You're completely knackered as well.
You're knackered, you're fired up. Adrenaline and testosterone for men, of course, Mrs. Thatcher had it as well, but never mind, are all mixed up there in a great soup, and yet you take decisions which can affect the rest of your government. It's just madness. The American system of having a period a month or whatever it is to change from one to another. So Tony Blair and I spoke that night. We spoke the day before, the day of the election. We agreed we'd go ahead to form the coalition, and then the following day, something had happened. He, I think, took the view, by the way, Roy Jenkins and I did as well, that with a majority of 150, it would have been bluntly undemocratic to add to that and to diminish the opposition. I mean, it doesn't sound...
Well, his other problem was explaining to his party, people like John Prescott, whopping landslide majority. Why on earth would we need Prescott would have called the frickin' Liberals?
Yeah, he did call them, and it wasn't always frickin' either. But No, but at that stage he could have done it. I mean, you know, at that stage he was walking on water. He certainly had that problem later on. Prescott and others prevented that from happening, and I understand why. Tribalism reasserted itself. But on the eve of that triumph, he could have done it. But both of us believed there was something slightly indecent about it. And I mean, I think we were wrong. We should have grabbed the moment when we could. And I think the course of British politics would have been a little different. Maybe, who knows, the course of the left. The one thing that Blair and I would never agree, he wanted to combine the Liberals with Labour. I said, I will not do anything that sacrifices the independence of the Liberals. We are important as an independent party, and you're not, in my view, a Liberal party to the extent. That would have been unsafe. But I can't tell you what would have happened over a period of, let's say, 10 years if the two parties had worked congenially together in government. I can't look that far ahead. So I think we lost a real opportunity, yes. And the question now is, can we in some form...
We're going to get to that.
We will. I'm glad you will.
Because you mentioned the Iraq War, which still reverberates to this day. Yeah. Indeed, we're still waiting for John Chilcot to produce his blessed report, which we're told is going to be 2 million words long and seems to have taken him longer than the entire duration of World War II or something like it. At the time, on the eve of the invasion, I know you supported the Iraq War. In fact, you wrote a letter, a private letter to Tony Blair, telling him he was doing the right thing.
I did.
Now, knowing what you know now, the obvious question is,
was I wrong?
Do you regret that?
Absolutely.
Were you wrong?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I take a particular interest in foreign affairs, and I think, if I look back to, you know, my work to try and get the international community to intervene in Bosnia, various other things, most of the judgments I think I'm satisfied with, but I'm clearly wrong. Now, this is going to sound like an excuse. None of it alters the bottom line fact that I did take a different view from that of my party. But at the time I was abroad in Bosnia, I was holding down an international coalition upon which I depended for the establishment of the peace in Bosnia. On both sides of that, there were people, it was France on one side, United States on the other. I was out of the loop from the parliamentary scene. I was looking at the thing from the distance, and bluntly, when my prime minister said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I believed him. I think if he had been here, I'd like to imagine I might have been a bit more sceptical. But that's the decision I took, and you're quite right. I wrote to him a private letter after the debate. Blair was, by the way, magnificent on the back foot, absolutely magnificent. It was a great parliamentary performance. And I wrote to him a letter saying, I think you're right, and I was wrong.
If we look at some of the other examples of what became known in quite a lot of circles as liberal interventionism, we had Kosovo, which were also an influential actor and a passionate advocate of, as was I. We had Iran, we've had Libya more recently. Do you worry, as somebody who believes there are occasions when you have to intervene in sovereign states to save people from their own rulers, if they're dictators, or to save their neighbours from dictators, do you worry that that creed is basically utterly discredited now and Western publics will simply not tolerate it anymore? Because it seems to have gone wrong in so many places where it's been tried.
I mean, just remember why it's gone wrong. It's not gone wrong because it was wrong to do it. It's wrong because we've done it so badly. I mean, when I came back from Bosnia, I wrote a book, by the way, it may be outside ready to sign as well. It's called Swords and Plowshares. And I wrote it because I was frightened exactly this would happen. And so I said, hey, guys, the problem with Iraq and Afghanistan is not what you did, but how you did it. In fact, the message that people have got is never again Iraq and Afghanistan. My message is never again do it like we did it in Iraq and Afghanistan. Almost everything that we did.
And Libya too.
And Libya too. And let me tell you, I mean, you have to read the book. It's very good, by the way. I'm still hardly available. But I conclude...
Do you give yourself 5 stars on Amazon as well?
I do, frequently, yes. Nobody else will, so why the hell shouldn't I? You see, what we fail to understand, we have been terribly distracted by shock and awe. Shock and awe did us a real damage. Prior to that, in Bosnia and in Iraq, George Bush Sr., We understood the dictum of Clausewitz that war is the extension of diplomacy by other means. It used the word politik, but that's what it means in German, diplomacy. So after shock and awe, and by the way, you know, if you thought what George Bush 1 did, he assembled a diplomatic coalition, that made, and the force was used within the diplomatic context. Shock and awe we've used. I mean, we now have got ourselves into the habit from shock and awe, same in Afghanistan, same in Syria, same in Iraq, same in Libya. We see a problem in the world and we want to bomb it. We think of no other thing but the politics, the diplomacy of high explosive. In fact, in Bosnia, we created the Dayton Agreement, which was international, involved the neighbours, underpinned by the great powers. And I've been saying for 3 years now, the stupidity of Syria is once again that we use high explosives to resolve a problem. What we should be doing was putting a wider diplomatic agreement together, a la Dayton, involving Tehran, involving a rapprochement with Tehran, involving the Turks, not easy, but you could do it, involving the moderate Arabs, and involving the Russians. They've got a bigger part.
It's their clients, say.
Well, it's not so much their clients. Our problem, we say, is jihadis returning from the battlefield. Their problem is the battlefield. In Dagestan and Chechnya are the battlefield for Sunni jihadism. They've got a really big dog in this fight. Why we didn't draw them in? I think it's because of the...
Well, they are in now, of course.
Yeah,
they're in physically.
But now on their terms, yeah, rather than on ours. We could have done this much easier. But my conclusion remains that in a very turbulent world, if we are not prepared to use international power to intervene in the domestic jurisdiction of other states when the wider peace is at stake, this is going to be a very, very, very much more dangerous world. But what you do, we think this is the age of high explosive. No, it's not. It's the age of diplomacy. And if only we had created a diplomatic context for the use of force in Syria, if we'd have surrounded Syria and ISIL by a diplomatic alliance, which would have strangled ISIL at birth, then using force makes sense. And it is one of the great misjudgments of our time that we are still locked into this idea from throughout the Western capitals that the biggest implement for changing the world is a piece of Western high explosive which destroys other people's lives.
We seem to be rather endlessly debating without conclusion whether British forces, although
no,
they
shouldn't.
Can operate over
Madness.
Iraq,
Madness.
Should go over the border into Syria. I was going to really ask us, shouldn't we question us so much as what difference would it make? Because we haven't got that many planes operating outside.
Well, make the point. I mean, we would be, if we decide we should go in, two things Britain should do, and it should have been doing for the last 3 years, working through the European Union to assemble that wider diplomatic construct. We haven't done it. We failed to realise this wasn't a war in Syria. It was a Sunni-Shia conflict. We failed to understand we couldn't get rid of Assad because the Russians would always protect. We made every mistake in the book. Now, at this stage, we can only outflank Putin on one front, because he's got the momentum. In terms of forces, I think he's going to find himself in much difficulty pretty soon. He'll want a way out. Maybe if we can create that diplomatic context, we can help him to get out of that. But that's where we should apply our effort. The idea that, was it five British tornadoes, is that what they are, will add a widow's mite of high explosive to a bloody mountain of high explosive that is already in the hands of the international coalition. By the way, most of which can't be used. The problem is, about, I think I'm right in saying 30 or 40% of the aircraft that fly off to bomb ISIL come back with the weapons still on board because they can't acquire the targets.
Yeah.
So what's the point? It is completely ludicrous. And if we were to do that, I mean, it would have zero military effect, but it would diminish our capacity to have political diplomatic effect in what the strategy I think we should be following. So it's nonsense. It's idiotic.
Now, some Americans were quite cross and stunned that Russians had moved in and blamed Obama. But you do hear other things from Washington. For instance, an American view, among some Americans anyway, jolly good, let the Russians stew a while in Syria. They can learn.
Well, there's an element of truth in that. I mean, yeah, but I think they've paid a terrible price. I warned...
The Americans?
Yes. Yeah. I warned 3 years ago, if you choose to use in Syria the only means that high explosive, there is a moment when the Russians, who've got far more than you, and they've got it on the ground, are going to come in and simply sideline you, which is exactly what's happened. So I think, I have to say, if this is a deep-laid strategy, it doesn't strike me as being a very intelligent one, and I'm sure it's not. It's a mistake. I could choose a stronger word. But there is, of course, Mr. Putin is a chess player, and he sees an opening, and he goes for it. I think he has made very considerable political capital, diplomatic capital out of this, because suddenly the Russians matter in the Middle East, where they never did up until now. I think Obama and America and the West position has been seriously diminished and eroded. But there is a truth that says that now Putin has to face up to the fact. It's easy to get into these things, but it's how you get out of them that matters.
With your face intact as well, yeah, which will matter a lot.
So he's fighting a war which I don't think his economy can support. It's a very weak economy. He's fighting a war which will generate instability in his own country, not least in those Islamic republics, Dagestan, Chechnya, etc. He's fighting a war in which he's going to discover, as we did, that simply using high explosives is not going to destroy terrorism. So having said he'll destroy them, he's soon going to discover he actually can't. And so it's a, you know, it's a short-term policy. People think Putin's a great strategist. I don't think so. I think he's a short-term opportunist. And I think he's going to want a way out pretty soon, which is why I think that the right thing to do is to build that diplomatic construct. We are beginning to do it now in the recent talks in Vienna. We would be able to outflank him diplomatically, and in the end he'll be forced to use this as a way out and to climb down.
Okay. Let's return a bit now to domestic politics. And I want you to think back to those heady days in 2010, just after the general election. British hung parliament. Chance opportunity for the Liberal Democrats, it seems, of a lifetime. You and Nick Clegg and others are discussing whether you can get into bed with the Conservatives. And I'm going to offer you the use of a time machine. You can get into my TARDIS and you can go back to that period in the spring of 2010 and warn your slightly younger self and Nick Clegg what, how it will end 5 years later. What would you say? Don't touch this, or would you still have gone ahead with the coalition?
Do it.
Do it.
Absolutely.
Despite what's happened.
Look, what am I in politics for, Andrew? I'm in politics to do the... Sorry if this sounds a bit self-righteous, but I'm genuinely in politics because I want to see the best of my country. I didn't believe we would suffer that much, and indeed we have suffered more than I thought. But, if the price... I'm sorry, this will sound odd, but if the price of doing what I believe was right for my country at that stage, standing in an economic crisis which was potentially as great as Greece, with a burden of individual debt as great as it was in Greece, with the markets prepared to go rampant, then, by the way, we'd had all those cuts made not by accountable politicians who can be removed from office and criticised, but by the markets who would be just as happened in Greece. At a lower level, I grant you, I'm not saying we'd have suffered the same as Greece, but we were suffering something very painful. And that there is an opportunity for the Liberal Democrats to take the risk of carrying the burdens of government with all that that means at a moment of crisis for my country. Would I recommend that? Absolutely. Now, I have to say, I was shocked by the fact that the only outcome was the Tories. I remember coining a phrase to that wonderful BBC commentator, Mr. Robinson, and I said that I thought the electorate had produced a perfect piece of torture for the Liberal Democrats. The mathematics went one way and our heart went the other. But my job was to try and see whether Labour was serious. They were never serious. They never wanted to do this. They weren't prepared to play a part. They wanted to leave office. They said so explicitly. They wanted to leave office, so they would not play a role in...
Some of the big figures, certainly Jack Straw, Alistair...
Well, not just Jack Straw. Yeah. I remember saying to Brown and Blair, look, in order for this to carry, we'd have been running a minority government. I said to both of them, you'll have to get the agreement of the people who will be the new Labour leaders when Brown stood down, Miliband the two Milibands and Mr. Balls. And both, all of them said, no, we don't want any part in this.
No, well, I agree with you.
So,
I mean, they thought
there was only one option, and the only one option
was... Well, the
was
other option was to let the Tories form a minority
government.
No, but
that wasn't an option. Come on, that wasn't an option. If that had happened, you would have had a minority government in the House of Commons. You would never have carried through the economic measures that would have stabilised us economically. Why would you? How could you have done that? And you'd have left the Tories open to return in September, a la Harold Wilson, saying, there you are, we'd like to govern. You know they're desperate times, but we're not being given. And then they'd come back with a thumping majority. How does that help anybody? So it was the right thing to do. I had some time. I was brought up under Mrs. Thatcher. You know, I found it very difficult to come to terms with this. But in the end, you had to. And when I looked at the coalition agreement, which had much more Lib Dem stuff in it than Tory stuff, I said to my... I made a speech, a little speech in the
parliamentary meeting, which used a naughty word again. I said, look, guys, I was against this, but now I'm looking at this. If you're going to do this, I can't other than be alongside you. And so I'm proud we did it. I think we made, by the way, a very good job of it. My guess is that that period of government will go down as one of the really good periods of government of our time. I think history will be very kind to it, especially in the light of what's happening now. So, no, I'm proud of it. And I'm particularly proud. I have a huge amount of time for Nick Clegg. I think he's made some mistakes. Who hasn't? But I really think he's one of the most decent, honest, courageous and politicians of excellent judgment that we've got. And it's a tragedy that we've lost him. A tragedy that we've lost him at this point, especially when we have to reconstruct the left. So, no, I was immensely proud of the way that our party, my party, which I belong to, having been 100 years out of government, showed the competence in the people of those who are ministers, better, by the way, than the Tories, and the sheer rock-solid courage to hold with it throughout, I think is terrific.
Anyway. OK, all that said, something must have gone wrong, mustn't it? Otherwise you wouldn't have just 8 MPs.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a slight collapse of the theory, but grant you. Just quickly on the election. I think we had lost 20 seats. I think we got 55 to 30 before we even went into that election campaign. The question is, why did we go from 30 to 8? I do think, and I hope this isn't just sort of hopefulness, that the collapse from 30 to 8 was specifically because the country was genuinely scared to death by opinion polls which didn't tell the truth, that Tories and Labour were neck and neck. And in those circumstances, the proposition of fear the Tories put had huge
Tories,
dramatic
eight
effect.
Eight your seats. Do you think part of your problem as a party, Nick Clegg perhaps particularly, is you underestimated just what ruthless bastards David Cameron and George Osborne are. They've been in coalition with you for 5 years and they say, oh, Vince Cable seat. Have that, thank you very much. Paddy Ashton's old seat. Yum, 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 yum. Like they just gobbled you up. They cannibalised
you. Hang on, are you saying that I'm naive? Is that what you're saying? I mean, are you saying...
Well, no, I'm just saying, had you forgotten the Tories were ruthless?
I didn't forget the Tories are ruthless. What I think you may not realise, well, you will, but probably not many in Britain will, do you know what they were able to spend in that campaign? Anybody know? 50 million minimum. I had to sell the family silver of the Liberal Democrats not to get to 3 million to fight an election campaign. The disparity of firepower on both sides was utterly massive. I mean, they were able to bombard all of our seats. Of course they did. I would do it to them, be no doubt. If I can get rid of a Tory, I'll bloody well do so. I will have no compunction, fear or guilt about it whatsoever. And if I had £50 million...
They're just better at it, though, aren't they?
No, they've got more money, Andrew. Haven't you got the point yet? They're not more better at it. If you come to assassination, I bet you I can beat a Tory anyway. All right?
Oh, you've answered an earlier question. looking back over those coalition years, what, if you had to identify the biggest single mistake your party made, either in how it presented coalition to the voters or in policy terms, what would you put your finger on?
Keeping the Rose Garden going too long.
The loving, too loving.
Now listen, I don't take the view that was a mistake. I mean, Britain had never had a coalition before. You had to give this some emotional quotient in the first days. This had to look about two people who were genuinely interested in cooperation, and they were, by the way. You couldn't have done this in the cold fashion that they would do it, for instance, on the continent, where you spend 3 weeks putting together a coalition programme. You don't have to. You can continue being nasty to each other. We haven't had an experience of coalition, so I think that was necessary, but probably went on for too long. The latter phase, which was, look, guys, this is a business deal. We don't love each other. We can be nasty to each other. We're doing business, okay? I thought that we just spent a smidgen too long, so that when we went into the election, I think people had a bit of doubt, particularly in the north of England, whether we did really love them. And we never loved them. I hate the Tories. I hate them. I spent all my life fighting them.
But I just want to budge you, because... It sort of echoes what you're saying. Didn't Tony Blair slightly put his finger on your strategic problem with the electorate when he said, if a party, the Lib Dems, sell themselves as a sort of leftish alternative to Labour for many years and then jump into bed with the Tories, you're likely to have a problem?
Look, Tony said that, and like many of the things that Tony says, it has some truth in it. I hope you got that.
I've never seen myself as a left alternative to Labour. Never. I'm something completely different. I believe in the empowered individual. I believe in the empowered citizen. I don't believe in big government. I believe in strong, powerful citizens. It's not Labour's belief. But yes, there is a certain tendency in our party to drift onto the easy grazing grounds. If I'm being very blunt, what John Maynard Keynes called the watery Labour men. There is a bit of tendency of that. And of course, Tony always used to play in it, particularly with Charles, by the way. I don't think he ever did it with me. It's not true. But insofar, I mean, you know, liberalism is somehow seen as by some as sort of wishy-washy and sort of not this and not that. You know, I think liberalism is the most muscular of creeds. It believes in internationalism, believes in the empowerment of the individual. This is not Labour. The fact is, Labour's gone crashing down because the old idea of corporatism, sustained Labour, of statism, by the way, being brought back by Corbyn, has no traction any longer. None whatsoever. Yeah, that's a kind of Blair insult of the sort that I get used to, but it has a bit of truth, but not much.
Let's get the audience to
join. I could be ruder than him about that.
Let's get the audience to join the conversation. Somebody got a question they'd like to ask. Yes, somebody with their hand up. Sorry, I can't see you that well because of the lights, but there you are.
Thank you. Many people create different variations of liberalism and liberal democracy, as you've just said. When it comes to the Middle East, what's your take on the occupation and the Arab nations fighting against Israel in the conflict? And also, what do you think about the inaccuracy of the BBC reportage of this? Thank you.
I can't comment on the inaccuracy of the BBC because I really don't know what you're referring to, but I can comment on Israel. Look, I will fight to the death for Israel's right to exist, and I will oppose anybody who says that they have a right or an intention to obliterate Israel. It is a state recognized by the United Nations. It is a democracy. I am not prepared to allow that to be placed in question from anyone. Having said that, there is no doubt, and sorry if I'm straightforward and offend some people, as I have done in the past, that the burning coal at the heart of the Middle East, which started this conflagration and to which it returns as an origin, a source from time and again, is the illegal occupation by Israelis, egregiously contrary to a UN Security Council resolution, of Palestine territory. And the West has done nothing about that. It's stood by and let it happen. And to such an extent that the second the two-state solution, the only solution capable of achieving anything, in my view, is in fact unviable because of Israeli facts on the ground with the settlements that are now so strategically placed across what would be the second state that the second state is itself unviable as a Palestinian state. So my worry about Israel is that is the Israeli government consistently follows the policies best calculated to bring about their worst nightmares. And their worst nightmare is they lose international support and they build the implacable enmity which tends towards a desire to destruction amongst all their neighbours. I actually believe that in the age of an integrated and interconnected world, one of the realisations and understandings you have to have is that the old concept of collective security doesn't work any longer alone. You have to also think of common security. You have to understand that in an interconnected world, you share a destiny with your enemy. It was that realization that enabled me as a young diplomat in Geneva in 1974 to participate in some of the greatest strategic arms reduction nuclear arms reduction talks with the Russians, because we both realized that in the nuclear age, we shared a destiny. It was in our interest of both of us to reduce the numbers. It's that realization of a shared destiny that at last my own people in Northern Ireland have come to understand that the zero-sum game, we win if we Protestants destroy you Catholics, or the other way around. And they've come at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement is the idea of a shared destiny. And the greatest impediment to peace in the Middle East,
You cannot have a peace in the Middle East that does not incorporate a peace in Israel, and between Israel and Palestine is a failure to understand between the Israeli people and government and the Palestinians that they have a shared destiny. Until they arrive at that conclusion, you can't arrive at a solution to what I will say again is the burning coal at the heart of the Middle Eastern conflagration.
Another question from the audience. This is a lady right at the front. Just wait for the microphone to come to you and then we'll all be able to hear you.
Hi, I've travelled from Leeds today and it's looking like the kind of a busy, booming town with its cranes and busy traffic.
Isn't it fabulous?
Pardon? Thing is about Leeds, it's not booming all over the north, and I wondered what you thought about the northern powerhouse.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, I think we have to rebalance our country. The question is whether whether our Chancellor of the Exchequer means it and in what sense he means it. So, I mean, leave that to one side. Let's take it at face value. We have to rebalance our country because it is ludicrously overbalanced in terms of London. By the way, I'm immensely proud of London. I mean, it's like another country. It reminds me of a Hanseatic city-state. And it's the world's only successful globalised city. So I'm immensely proud of it, but we have to do that. So I think the idea of rebalancing Britain towards the north in the way that is often articulated by Mr. Osborne and others is entirely right. How you go about that is a good question, but it has to be done. By the way, I remember, you know, not long after I was elected in 83, and again when I was Liberal leader in 88, Lib Dem leader in 88, I went up to those cities and they seemed like wastelands to me. Just terrible. It was so depressing. Now you go to Manchester and Leeds and your heart is lifted the whole time. You have real communities springing back to life and real energy and real determination and real pride of identity too. So I think all the ingredients are there to do that, and it is something that must be done.
Okay, another one. Yes, there's a gentleman at the front here. Just wait for the microphone to come to you.
Guardian can only afford.
You can all have a go as it goes along. If you like.
Do you think that the prospects of PR for the House of Commons are dead for a generation?
No, I don't actually. They're dead for the moment because the Tories aren't about to give away an electoral system that delivered them, however, fairly on 37% of the vote, a majority of whatever they've got, 17. But look, you've got a PR now developing everywhere else. You've got it in Scotland, you've got it in Wales. I think it'll come in due course in local government, particularly if you have more autonomy given to local government, which I'm strongly in favour of. You've got it at the European level. There's only just so long that miserable old deadbeat institution, the House of Commons, can hang on to the present system. They'll do so for as long as they can, but it'll be swept away, as indeed will the ridiculous institution to which I belong. I mean, you know, I went to the House of Lords for one reason, and that was to reform it and to make it a democratically elected.
But safe in the knowledge it wouldn't be proper.
No, absolutely. No, absolutely not. I mean, my absolutely not. I mean, the last government, we had a real chance of doing it. If Labour hadn't reneged, we would have done. There was enough support amongst the Tories in the House of Commons to carry that through.
Well, you know what the age-old problem is. Actually, it suits a lot of MPs.
The age-old problem is age.
It suits a lot of MPs to have an illegitimate House of Lords. It can never be a barrier to the executive.
Exactly.
And the government can always prevail when
it really wants to. Is that a democracy? Yeah. I mean, Andrew, there are only two ways of getting into the House of Lords, by the way. One is patronage of the Prime Minister, and the other is your great-grandmother slept with a king. And by the way, I think the second mechanism is often a better way to choose.
Oh, former Lib Dem leader you can be as well, can't
but,
you?
But look, I had the patronage of the Prime Minister.
Or did you sleep with the relative?
No, stop it, Andrew, at once. I had the patronage of the Prime Minister. But I mean, disgraceful way to get in. So I went in there because I want to get rid of it. By the way, it's my 75th birthday next year. I'm not sure that I'm not... I mean, I just think it's time... Probably time for me to it's not going to be reformed. I just feel like a white mouse running around that ridiculous thing. So we send young men and women abroad to kill and risk being killed themselves for democracy. And we haven't even got it in our second House of Parliament. It's a monstrous... there are 74 bicameral chambers in the world. Only four, as I recall, are non-elected appointed, One is Canada, one is Britain, the third is Belarus, and the fourth is Ukraine. This is the company we are in. It is monstrous. The House of Lords...
Well, Canadians are all right. What have you got against Canadians?
Yeah, I haven't, but I mean, they're foolish enough to follow us out of tradition or something. I mean, the House of Lords is a good revising chamber. That's fine. It takes the rotten laws produced by the House of Commons and makes sense of them as best as it can. That's a good function, but it has two functions. One is to revise, and the other is to act as a check and balance on the power of the executive. And this it cannot do, because it's a creature of the executive. I rather doubt you'd have had the Iraq War if you'd had an elected second chamber. I rather doubt you'd have had poll tax if you had the elected second chamber. This it does not do, and that is a blot and an escutcheon on our record.
That would sort of bring us to a slightly wider question, because since the election, Paddy, you've been talking about and advocating some kind of alliance of progressives to take on the Tories, as you put it. But how is this going to work? Because as far as I can see, you're not going to be uncomfortable in alliance with Jeremy Corbyn, are you?
Well, you're starting off from the wrong position, Andrew, I'm afraid. But so let me look.
Do you want another book plug?
The left, I think, at present has been broken and smashed in this country. And I think that's very bad for the country. And I think it's very bad for the Conservatives, by the way. They are already...
Lose their discipline. Yeah.
Well, they won't just lose their discipline. They become full of hubris, and they believe they can do anything. You have very clear evidence now. They've lost touch with what I think is reasonable policies, and in some cases even reasonable behaviour. And they'll go far too far. Very bad for them indeed. So we are looking at the same prospect as we looked at in 92. Are we really going to see a Britain permanently ruled for the rest of our sort of political life by the Tories? We have to do something on the left. Now, I think things have changed and they're different from 92 in this sense. That in 92, the power of Labour and the personality of Blair gave you only one polarity around which you could gather. But now Labour is much more broken too, and I think the left is much more pluralist. So I think we have to start a process. And by the way, I don't think this ends up with mechanical things. You have this seat, I'll have that. We'll have an alliance, I've got to vote with you. I don't think it ends up like that at all. I think you start this around conversations. I bet if I got four people, five people, a dozen people from across the political spectrum, maybe even some Tories, but certainly on the non-Corbynite wing of Labour, certainly many amongst the Greens, though not all, and many, many outside, I bet there's five, six, seven, a dozen key things we could agree on. We agree on internationalism, we would agree on Europe, we would agree on the question of not hiding from globalisation, but using it to create a successful economy and a fair society. We would agree on the power of the individual, on human rights. I bet that we would very simply agree. So I think bringing people together, starting an organic process based around ideas, is the way that we will begin this process. And then I think the European referendum becomes a mechanism by which that's stitched together into bonds of amity, rather like 74. And then you might think how in the second half of this parliament, I think this parliament will be divided into the pre- and post-referendum, we will have to consider how we can give that political effect. So
I just want to stop, press the pause button there. Political effect. I mean, are you into there? Election. You think growing into a new party or
no.
What?
No, I'm not. I am absolutely not. I'll talk to you about it then, but I don't want to lay out at this stage some sort of end point. I'm really much more interested in gathering people. The sadness is that I think you have to do this in the United Kingdom, not in a dismembered United Kingdom. I hope I'm not being too insulting. I don't believe terribly in the politics of insult, but I think what Mr. Corbyn has done is taken Labour away to be one of the stop the world, I want to get off parties. So we have it in the SNP and we have it in Mr. Corbyn's Labour Party, whose answer to globalisation is, I wish it would go away, we'll hide under the stairs and put the blanket over our heads. Sorry, this is being insulting, isn't it? You know, the Duke of Wellington, when shown the first train, he said, I'm against these things. They will enable the damn people to get about. He didn't know what British Rail would do, obviously. But the point is, it doesn't matter whether you like them or not, whether it's good or bad, whether you're against them or you're not. It's coming, and that's like globalization. So you can't, hiding from globalization is not the answer. We have to decide how is it in a free society we can deal with globalization while creating a successful economy and a fair society. Now, that's the argument that can be had. Let's see where that arrives at. Let's see how... I mean, my guess is we could create a number of points which we'd very easily agree. Let's see if we can come together. I don't want people... I don't believe people should abandon their parties, but I think an end of the sort of terrible, frightened tribalism that's gripping us at present.
Are you getting anywhere with this idea? Is anybody picking up the phone to have a conversation?
I'll let you know.
In the Ashdown salon?
It's not the Ashdown salon. I'll let you know in due course. Tell you what, give me 1,000 words in The Guardian and I'll lay it all out for you and then we'll see what kind of reaction
you'll just plug your
get.
Book, probably. let me just wait. The audience. Let's somebody with their hand up there.
I want to put forward an idea for you guys.
As a committed European, which I think you are...
I am passionate.
How do you view the prospects of the forthcoming referendum and the potential it has for the breakup of the union if there is a no vote or if there is an out vote and the Scottish Nationalists decide not to go along with that?
Well, you're dead right, sir. I mean, I have taken on the position of president of the European movement. I don't take any job at lower than presidential level at present. Joke, of course. Well, maybe not. I actually think you're absolutely right. I think what's at risk here is the great in Great Britain, both metaphorically and literally. When has this country's greatness been built on sheltering behind our island walls and shouting insults at foreigners? When? Since when has this country's greatness been built around isolationism that is now terrible, dangerous isolation? We are the nation that got engaged. We are the nation that's taken risks, including on the continent. We're the nation that gets out there. And this isolationism worries me more than anything else. But as you and if we were to withdraw from Europe, we would lose that engagement. And the United States, amongst others, sees it very clearly and said, don't bother. If you withdraw from the European Union, we just fly over London to get to Berlin. And we don't have any influence. By the way, we have to accept the laws of Europe, like Norway and Switzerland do, but we have no influence. Well, how does that make sense? And by the way, if we don't understand at this stage how much the terms of our existence have changed these last 10 years, we now have an America looking west across the Pacific, far more than east across the Atlantic, no longer prepared to serve as our defender of last resort, our friend in all circumstances. Eastern borders, we have a Russian president with tanks prepared to capture European territory. Southeast, we have the Arab world in revolt, and south of us, the Maghreb in flames. And all around us, individual powers now growing up bigger than individual economies in Europe. And we want to abandon our solidarity? That is madness. So we would lose our greatness. But we'd also lose literally the Great Britain, because the Scots would go. Of course they would. Couldn't say I'd blame them under those circumstances. Then you get England, little England, with Europe to the north, Europe to the west, Europe to the east, Europe to the south. But of course we're right, aren't we?
And we've still got Wales.
We may not have them as well. Yeah. And by the way, now we're permanently ruled by Tories. So this is a really good proposition. I'm very worried about the referendum. I think it's been badly handled by the Prime Minister. I don't think there's sufficient clarity at the moment.
Do you think he can lose it?
I'll answer the question in just a second. I think the refugee crisis is played to our disadvantage. So I think it's very, very narrow. If you put me up against a wall and said, we will shoot you, Paddy, if you don't tell us what the outcome is, I'll say we probably will win. But this is now so narrow that we don't have to make much of a mistake to turn that round. It's very serious, my dear. Very serious.
Let's have another question from the audience.
Are we running out of time at all?
Need to be quicker.
I want to put my fantastic
idea. The
ideas.
Gentleman there. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That gentleman there, in the middle.
Different subject. Where does global warming come in your thinking?
Absolutely crucial, sir. This is the biggest moral and practical challenge facing our time. And talking about assembling that, support for those ideas, that is going to be one of the big issues. I think we could make agreement about this. I have no doubt whatsoever that the number of people killed and whose lives will be blighted in the next 10, 15, 20 years, let alone 30, 40, 50, will be immeasurably greater as a result of global warming if we can't stop it, and it's getting very, very late in the day, than is ever going to be threatened or blighted by terrorism. And yet, this is the really serious issue we have to confront.
Okay, another one.
I want to put my idea. It's revolutionary. I want to put a revolutionary idea. You heard it here in The Guardian first.
Yeah, you'll have to do it in about 3 minutes.
Oh,
yes,
God.
Please answer your question.
You mentioned the refugee crisis. With the discrepancy between the reality of the situation and the government's response to it,
What do you think Britain should be doing, and do you think there's room for the government to change its position?
Absolutely. I mean, you cannot... By the way, the refugee crisis is... This is the new normal. And by the way, it's the past normal too. Only for the last 30 years have you not had... Europe has always had these great waves of people sweeping across it. We are the product of it, by the way. Or, as Churchill said, we're a nation of mongrels. So always has been the case. There have been tides of people sweeping to avoid war or pestilence or famine. And by the way, it's coming back. This is only in the last 30 years you haven't had it. This is the beginning of the future. And by the way, this is going to be much greater when this isn't fleeing from war, but it's fleeing from global warming. Then you will see this as a global phenomenon. In the Southeast Asia, where I was, Kuala Lumpur not long ago, they already see it in those terms. So this is a major issue to which it is not going to be dealt with by spatchcock policies. And we Europeans can only deal with it on a European level. So we won't even solve the problem, the tiny problem that we have of 3,000 banging on the doors of the Channel Tunnel, except within a European place. So we have to play our part in this, because it's right to do so, it's morally defensible to do so, it's morally the proper thing to do, but it's also the practical thing that will resolve our issue. Of course, we're not finding it easy to solve this issue. Who would, with a million people turning out suddenly at your borders? But the fact that Britain has excluded itself from this, refuses to play a part in giving a home to the refugees who are in danger, instead has decided to give it to the refugees who aren't in the camps, who aren't in danger but are in the camps, this, I think, is morally indefensible and practically not in our country's interest.
Now, Paddy, you said you were bursting.
Right. I've got a minute.
Bursting
right,
with a
go.
Big idea.
Here we go.
Before you explode on us, I'd better let you ventilate your big idea. What's your big idea?
Civilization, democracy, one of the great moments was the ownership of property. There's a piece of property we don't own, but it is ours. It's our data. So our data is used, whether we like it or not, by the great corporations, Google, Amazon, blah, 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 without referring to us, to make them squillions. Why? How about a law that said, property is mine and my data belongs to me? Now, if Google wants to use my data, they have to ask me and pay me a share they make out of data.
Ladies and gentlemen.
So it was that great man Thucydides who said at the burial, funeral oration of Pericles, every man shall be a lord and master of his own person. Every man and woman can be a lord and master of their own data. If we would introduce a law in this country, preferably a European law, that says every citizen owns their own data, and if you want to use it, Mr. Google, Mr. Amazon, you must ask them and pay them a share of the profits. You have completely altered the relationship between these great mega corporations and the individual. You're empowering the individuals and you're making them accountable. Isn't that a great idea? You've heard it here.
Let's have a quick popular vote. Who likes that idea? Put your hand up.
Yes.
So who's here from Google or Facebook and really thinks this is a very bad idea?
So now...
There we are. Look, you've swept. At least here you've swept.
You are. If only you'd all vote Liberal...
If only the election had been like that.
If only you'd only vote Liberal Democrat, we would have had... Can I just make the point? To The Guardian, I hope they saw that huge support. I want 1,000 words in The Guardian to explain this, all right? You promise it, me, Andy.
Now, we're drawing to a close, alas. As I think might have been mentioned, but I will mention it anyway, Paddy will be signing some books afterwards for anybody who cared to buy one. And if you prefer a rare unsigned copy of one of his books, you could buy one of those too. It all remains for me to thank you all for coming to this Guardian live event and to thank my guest Paddy Ashton.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.